Anna D. Wells versus Unisource Worldwide.
May it please the court, counsel. Now, this is a case where my client worked for the defendant since 1993. A determination was made by the trial court that summary judgment was appropriate with respect to all claims that she made concerning her discrimination claim. We feel that that determination was erroneous because it required the weighing of evidence, which on summary judgment is inappropriate. Specifically, what the court determined was, first of all, that there was, although there was no contest that a prima facie case had been established on her termination, where her position was transferred to Wisconsin, and she was one of 10 credit administrators, and all 9 white credit administrators remained in their position, and she did not, although she had seniority on some of them. Still, the court felt that the plaintiff was not in a position to rebut the argument that these transfers were legitimately done rather than discriminatorily done. Again, we feel that...
Wasn't she offered a chance to move?
She was offered an opportunity to move to Wisconsin.
Is that so bad?
No. Obviously it's not. And I wouldn't say it here in front of...
You lose two right off the reel.
But I think the problem was that, and she made that clear to them, that she had family here, she had kids here, who were in school. No one else was given the choice. I won't say the Hobson's choice.
I thought two of them did move.
No. In fact...
the other party didn't move either.
Right. The other administrator whose position was eliminated, that was Ms. Nowicki, I think it was, in Nowicki. Her position was eliminated after she had already obtained another position. So she did not get terminated from the job. She was just simply placed in a different position.
She took some other job, didn't she?
That's correct. None was offered to my client.
A lower-paying job or what?
I'm not certain whether it was lower-paying or not, but... She did get another job. My client did not get another job, and my client was seeking other jobs.
But your client did not make an application for the other job until after hers was over with, isn't that true?
Well, she made an application to a number of jobs. I mean,
But not until the other job was terminated.
Well, not until she was told it was going to be terminated. She began applying before she was actually terminated from her position. So she did continue to apply for positions while she was still working for them. We simply feel that under the circumstances, especially given the fact that this was a situation where my client had previously settled to get that position based on an EEOC charge previously that she was being denied it discriminatorily in the past, that there is at least room for a reasonable jury to determine either that she was discriminated against or retaliated against with respect to that position. And there's yet another issue. My client was advised when she was terminated that should another position become available, that she would be put in that position. Another position, in fact, did become available.
If she was qualified, isn't that true?
Well, of course. And my client was qualified, and although there's some dispute as to whether she was more qualified than the person who got it, again, that requires a weighing of evidence. They required that the argument was that they required 3 to 5 years of fine paper experience, they called it. My client had been involved in fine paper in another capacity. The person who was ultimately hired for the position didn't even used to work for the company. So to say that she had more experience in a field that she never worked at least is open to argument. So our position is with respect to all of the issues, particularly the pretext issues, because those are the ones that are really challenged in all of the arguments made here, the discrimination claim as to her termination, the discrimination claim as to her not being rehired, and the retaliation claim. The real nexus of this whole case falls upon the legitimacy of the argument there. Our position is...
Is it your contention that these two jobs were transferred into Wisconsin, that reasoning it was pretextual?
Yes, and the reason we say it's
pretextual... And why was it?
Because my client also had accounts in Illinois. a number of accounts in Illinois that she handled in addition to Wisconsin accounts. And when she was terminated, her Illinois accounts were simply distributed to other administrators. So she did not solely work on Wisconsin matters. She worked on Illinois matters as well. So again, we feel that these are issues that are properly to be determined by a jury, not by a judge in summary judgment. And therefore, we feel respectfully that the judge's decision was wrong. We'd like to reserve the balance of our time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Joshua Vincent on behalf of the defendant appellee, Unisource Worldwide. As you know, this is a race discrimination and retaliation case, and the two components are the transfer of the plaintiff's job and the alleged failure to rehire her. I am only going to argue the pretext issue because I think that does cut to the factual heart of this case, because it's our position that the plaintiff has never been able to adduce any evidence that draws into question the legitimacy of the business reasons that were given for the employment decisions that were made in this case. The transfer of the plaintiff's position occurred in March of 2000. And the reason that that occurred was because about a year before that, Georgia Pacific had acquired Unisource. And it was about a year later that it became clear that the credit administration roles for Wisconsin-based accounts were split geographically between Wisconsin and Illinois. They had two credit administrators in Illinois who handled what they call supply systems accounts for Wisconsin-based customers and Wisconsin sales representatives, and there were two who were still in Wisconsin. And the company determined that it was more efficient if the positions that handled credit administration for the Wisconsin sales team were physically located in Wisconsin. And so as a result of that determination, two positions, not just the plaintiffs, and this is undisputed, two positions were eliminated in Illinois and transferred to Wisconsin. Now, there's no question that there were other credit administrators in Illinois, and there's no question that some of those administrators had less seniority than the plaintiffs. There's no question that some of those credit administrators were white. But the point that's dispositive here is that the motivation was race neutral. It was a geographic determination that dictated the elimination of those positions, because the plaintiff cannot adduce any evidence that there was a single credit administrator position left in Illinois that handled Wisconsin accounts. And that's really the crux of the problem with the plaintiff's case on the transfer. If the plaintiff could show some evidence that a Wisconsin credit administrator was left in Illinois, then that would make Unisource's reason for the transfer look false. But that's the evidence that's lacking in this case, is something that suggests that there was a non-geographic reason for the transfer of the positions. And there's nothing that really draws that into question. The plaintiff can't show any differential treatment because, as I said, there's no one with Wisconsin responsibilities left in Illinois. They're all moved to Wisconsin. The other basis that plaintiff tries to draw into question the propriety of this decision is the testimony of a woman named Joanne Turner, a co-worker of the plaintiff's, who contends that one of the decision makers concerning the transfer of the position, in her words, had a problem with people of color. Now that may be true, we don't know, but the problem with Ms. Turner's testimony is that, number one, she cannot identify anything, any overt act or statement by this individual to support that suggestion that this man is a bigot. She says that it is her sense in dealing with him that he has this problem, but she can't connect it up to any employment decision that he ever made. And that's, there's very clear case law in this circuit that the race discrimination laws, they don't create an action simply because someone is a bigot. The bigotry has to be connected to an employment decision. And that connection, that nexus, is what is completely lacking with respect to Joanne Turner's testimony about this management-level employee, Walt Welch. The other problem with Ms. Turner's testimony is that she was not a part of the decision-making process in terms of the decision to transfer. So she really doesn't know what factors went into the decision to transfer these positions. So all of her testimony regarding the alleged racial bias of one of the decision makers is really speculation, and that's exactly what the district court found, and the record supports that, because there just isn't anything to connect that decision or that bigotry with the decision in this case. The second issue is the failure to rehire. And one of the things...
The failure to what, please?
Rehire. I'm
all right,
sorry.
All right.
The one thing I think you have to understand in approaching that issue is the difference between what they call credit administration responsibilities for fine paper accounts and credit administration responsibilities for supply systems accounts. The plaintiff's own testimony, which is at page 34 of her deposition in the exhibits to our summary judgment motion, or our statement of uncontested facts, she herself explained that fine paper accounts were much more complicated. They typically involved very large accounts, such as OfficeMax or Allstate. They generally involved portfolios in the millions of dollars. Plaintiff herself testified that supply systems work, which is what she did, was far less complicated. It involved much smaller portfolios, smaller types of accounts. The position that the plaintiff applied for required 3 to 5 years experience in fine paper. The plaintiff had 1 year of experience in supply systems. The person who was hired had 10 years of experience handling portfolios of the size that were involved in the fine paper account. So the decision to hire the other individual over the plaintiff was based strictly on the qualifications, and again, there's nothing that the plaintiff has identified that draws the legitimacy of that employment decision into question. The plaintiff says that there was a promote from within or a hire from within policy, and this person was from outside the company. There's no evidence of such a policy in this record. If you look at the plaintiff's deposition, again at page 36, she states that it was her view that the company should hire from within, but that's not evidence that the company had a policy that it hired or promoted from within. There's also a letter dated September 11th of 1998 from the HR director, which is attached to the plaintiff's evidentiary submissions in support of their statement of undisputed facts, and that letter makes it clear that while we would like to hire from within, it is not a policy of the company, and we reserve the right to hire only the most qualified individual. The letter expressly states that. So when we have a situation here where the company made a decision to hire a person who, although white, was clearly more, hands down, more qualified than the plaintiff was for this particular position, there's no violation of any policy involved there. And I think that also disposes of the plaintiff's argument about this purported promise that she could get the next job that opened. That's not the plaintiff's testimony. There's no testimony that a promise of the next job that opened was made. The person who terminated her told her that they would try and slide her into another position that became available. That's not a promise that they're going to hire her for the next one that comes available, whether she's qualified or not. The company has the right, under the law and under its own policies, to select the person who is the most qualified. And there is nothing, again, that counsel can point to that draws into question or somehow raises a flag that there's something false or funny going on here about whether or not the decision that one individual was more qualified than another was motivated by race in any respect. The retaliation claims that are made in this case are based on all the same facts, so I'm not going to obviously re-argue all of those facts that I just went over. The only two features that are different with respect to the retaliation claim is there is a substantial passage of time between when the plaintiff made her charge of discrimination in 1998 and the action in this case. It's a period of about 19 months, and this court has held periods far shorter than that. Standing alone are not enough to raise an inference of retaliation. The other important point, I think, is that the person who selected the other individual for the credit administrator position that plaintiff applied for, that decision maker was unaware that the plaintiff had filed a discrimination charge some nearly 2 years earlier. So without that knowledge, there couldn't have been any retaliation involved. Unless the court has any specific questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment below.
Right, counsel, that's all.
Thank you. Counsel argues that there's no evidence of anything false or funny in this record, but even by the judge's own statement, he indicated that the termination of my client was at least an oddity, although his argument was that oddity is not enough to establish pretext.
Our point would be that it's enough to raise an issue of fact here based on the perpetual, the constant oddities that took place. Counsel says it's all geographic. I stress again, my client's accounts were not simply in Wisconsin. They were in Wisconsin and Illinois. So I feel that the termination issue, there were some sufficient facts to raise an issue of whether pretext could be established, especially given the fact that it was admitted that a prima facie case had been established. On the failure to rehire, counsel touts the obvious superiority of Ms. Jablinski, who was hired for the position. But another interesting point made at page 9 of the opinion was that the judge made the point that Ms. Jablinski's resume was never even submitted for consideration, so that an objective determination could be made as to how she stood so far, head and shoulders above my client, when she had never even worked for the company before. You have to remember that she came from...
So was she interviewed?
I'm sorry?
Was she interviewed before?
Ms. Jablinski?
Yeah.
It's not clear in my mind from the record whether she was or was not. I believe she was, but I just honestly don't recall.
And was her 10 years experience recounted in her resume?
I don't know. Again, that's the problem. Even raised by the judge, the resume was never produced.
I see. And it isn't in this record.
It isn't in the record.
Thank you.
That's the point that the judge made. On the retaliation issue, counsel talks about the fact that the passage of time defeats the possibility of establishing a retaliation claim. It's not entirely the case, especially given the fact that the decision to terminate based on downsizing was made at that time. It wasn't a decision to be made when my client was first put in the position. It would have been an absurdity to settle a discrimination case, putting her into a position that's going to be eliminated right on the spot. But the first time that there was any question as to which of the credit administrators would be terminated, out of 10, my client was the one who was terminated. Also, counsel argues that the person who made the decision was unaware of the previously filed claims of discrimination. That also is not correct, because the decision was made by Mr. Fresky as well as Alice Gorman. And Ms. Gorman had participated in the arguments concerning the EEO complaint from the beginning. So she was very much aware that my client had filed EEO complaints, and she was involved in this decision as well. For all these reasons, we feel that my client should have had an opportunity to take her case to a jury. The jury could make a determination. They could weigh the evidence. Counsel could make the arguments he makes here, and then a determination could be made. So we'd ask respectfully that the judge's determination be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement, and the court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m.